This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity.
Good morning, and welcome to a special community conversation from VPR News, reflecting on yesterday's news that former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has been convicted of all three counts in the murder and manslaughter of George Floyd. I'm Jane Lindholm.
Today, people are still processing the emotions of Chauvin's conviction. People are feeling relief, sadness, anger, and a renewed sense of determination that this is not the end point in the fight for racial justice.
And of course, that is Connor Cyrus making his hosting debut today. I'm so pleased to be hosting with you today, Connor, especially on what feels like a momentous occasion. Thank you for joining us. I'm really thrilled to be hosting this special with you.
I'm excited to be here. You know, this is just such an important conversation, and I'm excited to be able to bring Vermonters' voices to the air and, you know, really continue to dive in deep on this conversation.
Me too. And let's start by just sharing some of the reactions from state officials and our congressional delegation, which all have been calling for a continuation of the work toward racial justice. In a statement released last night, Governor Phil Scott said, quote, "We cannot treat the racism that led to Mr. Floyd's murder as if it is a single, uncomfortable and rare event. We must acknowledge that over many generations, systemic racism was built into our social systems, our economic systems, and everything in between."
And Vermont's Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray also released a statement. She wrote, "While today's verdict marks a moment of accountability, the verdict neither solves police violence in America nor brings George Floyd back to his family or loved ones. This is not the end, but the beginning of a long path of police reform, criminal justice reform, and a collective effort to root out systemic racism across our country."
Attorney General T.J. Donovan, the state's top law enforcement official, wrote, "I'm grateful that there was accountability for George Floyd's murder, but the work for justice continues."
Now, Jane, before we get into this conversation, I just want Vermonters, as we are thinking about this, you know, as I'm on social media, I'm seeing that there are two big words that come out in this conversation. One of those being accountability and one of those being justice. And so I want to hear from Vermonters and just hear your thoughts. Was it justice? Is there accountability? And what more needs to be done?
Yeah, so that is going to be an important point in this conversation. What are you hearing so far in reactions that Vermonters are sharing with you that are sort of out there in the ether, Connor, as we think about the ways people reflect on this verdict? And more than just this momentary verdict, you know, what this means? Does this spur action? Is it justice or accountability? Is it both or neither? You know, how are you hearing people react?
You know, it's funny because a lot of people are telling me, and what I'm reading is that there's a sense of relief, but it's not enough. That they're relieved, that they're temporarily relieved, but there's still a huge weight that I think a lot of people, especially in the BIPOC community, don't want people to get comfortable that this is the norm, that this is what we can expect from here on out. I think that a lot of them really see this as a starting point and just that.
All right. Well, let's go to a guest here as we get some calls lined up as people start to share with us what they are thinking and feeling, what you are thinking and feeling. Jessica Brown joins us now. She's the supervising attorney in the Chittenden County Public Defender Office, and she will be joining the Vermont Law School in the fall as a visiting professor of criminal law and procedure. Jessica Brown, thank you very much for joining us today to talk a little bit about this case and what might happen next. Appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
What was your initial reaction when you heard the verdict read by the judge yesterday?
Relief, just like Connor said. Relief for George Floyd, for his family, and certainly for the community of Minneapolis, which has, you know, experienced this trauma since May of last year. But I agree with the sentiments that what we're seeing is accountability, but not justice, because justice would be George Floyd being alive, right? Justice would be, you know, approaching harm in this country completely differently than we currently do. Justice would be, you know, that four officers would not respond to a call for an alleged fraudulent $20 bill and end up, you know, with one of those officers pressing his knee on a man's neck for almost 10 minutes. So I agree. like Connor, I have been following a lot of reaction on social media, and I really appreciated how Amanda Gorman phrased her reaction. She's the poet from this year's presidential inauguration, and she said, "A reminder that victory would be George Floyd being alive. Every day Black Americans worry if they will be next is another day without justice." So we're certainly still worrying as Black Americans every day whether or not it will be me or some member of my family or a friend of mine or just any other, you know, Dante Wright, the next Black person who we're going to read about. And we didn't even get through, literally did not even get through hearing the verdict before another girl, young teen girl, was killed by police in Ohio. So that's where we're still at.
I'm curious, what do you think it would take to see justice here in Vermont? And how do we go about achieving that in our day-to-day lives?
So in anticipation of this conversation this morning, I was actually reading a little bit, refreshing my memory about kind of what actually happened on the day that George Floyd was killed. And I don't think I realized that the owner of the store where George Floyd allegedly had passed a counterfeit bill was really known in the community for not involving the police for minor incidents at his store. He was quoted as saying that he trained his staff to only involve the police if there was violence in the store. And typically something like a counterfeit bill would not have been a reason to call the police. I believe that the staff person who did call the police was fairly new, had only been working in the store for a few months, and maybe hadn't been trained or didn't understand the procedure. But I thought that was a really good example and one that I hope people would look to for how in our communities we can be responding to harm without immediately going to the police or going to our criminal legal system as it currently stands, as it currently works. People in communities who want to respond differently to harm can come together, can come up with ideas for how to intervene, how to respond to harm that don't immediately involve calling the police. Know your neighbors, know your mental health agency in your county or in your city or your town, know numbers to call that are not 911 when you think someone is having a mental health crisis, or when you think, if you have an emergency that doesn't necessarily need police response, but for which you need assistance. I think of it as there's this concept called pod mapping, and if this was a visual medium and we weren't on radio, I would show you what one looks like, but. You know, I'm the center of my pod, and I identify all of the people in my immediate vicinity and then in my larger community who I can turn to if I need help, or, you know, other resources that I can turn to if I think other people in my community need help without immediately going to the police. The general idea being that, you know, what we can do in Vermont from an individual standpoint, as well as community, towns, cities, our legislature, our law enforcement agencies, our mental health agencies, our community justice centers, we can all be working to come up with ways to respond to harm in our communities that don't necessarily immediately involve the police as a first step.
Jessica, can I ask you, is that a workaround because some communities feel and are unsafe? Or is that something that will be a structural change for our society to make generally when it comes to how we as a whole community think about the role of police and policing and the role of other people in dealing with crisis situations? I mean, is this a way to protect people who are currently unsafe, or is this a structural change that you think we need to be making?
I do, you know, I think my answer speaks to ways that individuals can start to change their thinking. But when you talk about structural changes, I mean, really what we need to be talking about, what the conversation needs to be, is that the way we really prevent crime and dangerousness and violence in our communities is by investing in the supports and the services that people in the communities need. So those are the structural changes that need to be happening. And those are the conversations that our legislature and our law enforcement agencies, our state's attorney's offices, our other community resources need to be talking about. We need to be investing in making sure people have stable housing, employment, job training, education, mental health services, treatment for substance use disorders. I mean, I don't think I'm saying anything revolutionary or that most people haven't heard or thought about, but when you're talking about structural changes, that's where the conversation needs to go.
Let's get in some of the voices of Vermonters who are reacting to the verdict yesterday and to the path forward. We have that tape now. Let's listen to how two Vermonters are reflecting.
This is Alicia Carter from Milton, Vermont. When I saw the Chauvin verdict, I felt relieved, I think. We've seen other cases like this that should have come to the same conclusion and did not. It's obviously not a happy feeling. No matter what the verdict is, there's still a man that was murdered. But there's a hopeful feeling that hopefully things will change in the near future.
My name is Brooke Dooley and I live in Burlington. I'm not feeling relief today. I'm feeling like a breath I've been holding for a year. I've finally been able to exhale it. And the irony of that statement is not lost on me. The irony that George Floyd was not allowed the same privilege of exhaling is not lost on me. I see a lot of my friends, most of whom are white, celebrating on social media today, and I get that. Like, I get that this feels like a win, but a consequence for an action is not a win. We lost Micaiah Bryant 20 minutes before the verdict was read in Ohio by police officer involved violence, and the systemic problems that we have in this country relating to policing, the exorbitant amount of control that police unions have over our justice system hasn't been ameliorated at all. And until those things happen, I don't feel like I can feel relief. I don't feel like any of us should be celebrating.
Rick is calling in from Adamant. Hi, Rick. How are you reflecting and reacting and thinking about next steps?
Hi, thanks. Yes, it just reminds me of Martin Luther King's saying that, well, this is the moral arc of history bending a little more towards justice. And I think, you know, we need to just realize we have a lot of bending still to do. So let's all stay vigilant and busy and bend that moral arc further towards justice.
Thanks for thinking about that, Rick, and weighing in. Let's go to Robert in Burlington. Hi, Robert.
Hi. Well, the thing yesterday, I think, was the only possible just verdict, and I'm glad that they came to that just verdict. Otherwise, I think Minneapolis would be burning again, and I have three nephews who live in Minneapolis that I would be fearing for their safety. But what I'm calling about is I'm in terms of Vermont and Burlington in particular, I'm just disgusted by the lack of accountability. We had Phil Grennan and we had Wayne Brunette that were both killed at the hands of police. Unnecessarily, and there really was no discipline involved with that. The only time that there was any discipline involved that I remember reading in the news was the Jason Belavance when he assaulted this person that he walked up to. It was recorded on his body cam, and what we did with Jason Belavance is we paid him off to leave. We paid him $250,000 for him to go away, and that's such a moral hazard, and I really feel that only Councillor Ali Jang got that one right. The entire city council, the entire city government got that wrong, and they introduced a moral hazard in our police department by paying off this cop to leave rather than just firing him.
Robert, I hear the anger in your voice. Do you feel like you can take personal action now? Is this something you're going to be advocating for moving forward?
I'm so spent on the pot recently. I mean, I'm spread thin. I feel like on The Hobbit. I'm butter spread too thin on the toast myself. But I am angry, and I will speak up about it. But in terms of screaming at a city corner, that's what happened last summer.
Yeah. Well, Robert, I appreciate your call and perspective. Thank you.
Now, Jessica, Robert just spoke about the lack of action and the lack of accountability that police have taken. What is happening in the criminal justice system that prevents police from being held accountable?
Those decisions are made by other people than me. I'm a public defender, so, I have similar questions, right? That's really a question. And with some of the older incidents that Robert was referring to, I don't want to mess up the timeline. So I'm not sure which of these decisions would have been with the current Attorney General, T.J. Donovan. But, those are decisions that come from him, from whoever is in the Attorney General's position. Let me qualify that. Certainly, some decisions are within individual law enforcement agencies, but other decisions about whether to prosecute law enforcement officers for arguably criminal conduct is certainly within the power of the Attorney General. I think he always speaks about it when he makes a decision. And generally, those decisions have been not to prosecute law enforcement officers who have, arguably engaged in criminal conduct. And generally, my understanding is that when he's assessed those cases, he has felt that the police officer's conduct either didn't rise to the level of a crime or was justified, and maybe didn't rise to the level of a crime because it was justified.
So it's a simple answer for people at home if they don't like how police are being held accountable, that they have to put pressure on their elected officials?
Absolutely. Every county has a state's attorney, and who's the chief prosecutor, really the chief law enforcement person for the county. And then the Attorney General is the chief law enforcement agent for the state. And these are all elected officials. And if you want to see reform, if you want to see a different approach to harm in your community, if you want to see a different response to police misconduct in your community, yes, you should be engaging with your elected state's attorney. You should be engaging with Attorney General Donovan. You should be telling them both when you are troubled by their actions and their decisions, and you should also tell them when you support their actions and decisions, because I know that those state's attorneys in particular who are reform-minded hear from people who are not happy with their decisions. They also need to hear from their constituents who support their efforts at reform in the criminal legal system.
And now we're going to welcome Tabitha Moore into the conversation. She's a former president of the Rutland NAACP. Tabitha, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How are you feeling today?
I have all kinds of feelings right now. But what comes to my mind first is the idea that we've even seen accountability yet. When I think about the process here, the first thing is acknowledgement, and then there's accountability, justice, restoration, and transformation. And I think throughout this whole thing, the thing that's going through my mind is that don't forget that no one in the police department was going to roll on Derek Chauvin and the other three until the video surfaced, until people started to be like, wait a second, this is what just happened. So I think it's really important to acknowledge that all that's happened so far is that we validated the reality that Derek Chauvin killed a man. We haven't even gotten to accountability yet. And actually, that's where I get worried about what's about to happen. So we're still a long way from justice, let alone restoration or transformation. So that's kind of what's on my mind. And so as I hear people even using the word celebrate, if we're celebrating or even feeling relieved, which I admit I felt a degree of relief, that we're validating the basic reality that we all watched a video of a police officer killing a black man. If we're celebrating that, it tells us just how broken our system is, just how much work we have to do to transform it and make it actually a system that works for people.
This murder, I think, really hit the BIPOC community extra hard, especially mothers. How does a verdict, if anything, change the way you talk to your kids about what happened?
Well, it's funny because my son, who's 13, reached out to me as it happened. He texted me, he said, "Mom, you know, George Floyd's murderer was found guilty on all three charges." And I said, "You know, that's right, son. What do you feel about that?" And he said, "Honestly, I don't even care unless he gets a life sentence." And this is my 13-year-old who recognizes that, again, we really haven't found justice anywhere yet. So for me, you know, as a parent in all of my roles, it doesn't really change anything because, again, the system is still as messed up as it was before. It was just a great deal of public pressure that got us to this point.
Tabitha, you mentioned that you don't think that this verdict even gets us to the point of accountability. So what was it, if not accountability? What was it?
It's a gateway to accountability. All we just did was collectively watch a video and say, yep, he murdered that guy. And yep, that was extremely racist. That's all we've done. And now accountability is, what is going to happen to Derek Chauvin because of it? So that's the individual accountability piece, right? But then there's the systemic accountability piece, right? Like I said, nobody in that department was going to roll on Derek Chauvin if that 17-year-old had not put that video together out there. It would have been another, you know, it would have been Tamir Rice. It would have been everybody else. So I think in order for us to get to accountability, we have to maintain this level of public pressure, which I think, as one of your callers said, we're exhausted. We're spread thin. Is this really what we have to do to get the system to work the way it's supposed to? And that's not even justice. That's not even what is needed to begin to help this family heal. I mean, maybe it's a step toward that. But then, again, all of the ripples of across the nation of fear and, continued lack of justice are still out there and have just been kind of awakened by this even more, you know, just reminded of it. So there's so much more work to do.
So this isn't your job, but what do you want white Vermonters to do to pick up that mantle, to carry some of that burden, to deal with the pain and exhaustion that BIPOC Vermonters are feeling with and, you know, offer some relief and some change?
Right. I think, you know, my answer here is twofold. I think for me as a BIPOC Vermonter, self-care and self-care for all my BIPOC Vermonters is really critical. Seeing each other, healing each other, just being in relationship with each other is probably the most important thing for us right now, and for us to vision our future and how we want it, so that as white people start to listen and get their resources ready to reimagine a safer Vermont, that, you know, we are driving that vision. White folks have to be listening, not just listening, but stop making excuses for why you can't do things like TJ Donovan, like, you know, anybody with power, like the legislature. You know, they're trying, but again, the ways that the systems are working aren't working for people. They're not working for people that are even in them trying to make changes. So I think that white folks have got to be talking about deep systemic change. We have to stop trying to arrange the deck chairs on the Titanic and deal with our legislative and structural issues that are preventing true justice from taking shape. Even those who work in law enforcement, in criminal justice, will tell you it is not working the way it's happening. So rather than talking about, you know, even how we can be in relationship with each other, which, again, is a critical component, we need to be talking about massive structural change in realistic ways.
What would you like? I guess, you know, you talk about this in a very grand idea. But how do you make the? How do you simplify this for people at home so they really understand that BIPOC are exhausted, that they need help and they want help, and to really further the conversation so we're not stuck in this loop of this conversation over and over and over again after another black person gets killed?
Well, I think number one is to realize that transformation is possible on the individual and the collective level, and that starts with, like, yeah, you can do your individual actions. You can Venmo, you know, money to BIPOC. You can stand there if you see BIPOC interacting with police. You can have book clubs where you're challenging yourself to open your eyes and do things differently. But unless you're really looking at Black feminist queer theory and really understanding the visions for future and then coming from that perspective, I think it's going to be difficult. I think, you know, we really do need to revision what public safety looks like And then I think, again, I mean, it's the same thing we've been saying every time something happens. Every time I'm on here, I'm talking about how, you know, when things like this happen, the expectation that BIPOC will, that we are going to be the ones that you turn to and apologize to, it's overwhelming. But, you know, I guess my advice to white people would be, you just got to start trying and be ready to apologize. Like, you're going to mess it up. Because we have to co-create this and recognize that people aren't going to necessarily be trusting right off the bat. But again, for me, I'm kind of tired of trying to arrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. I want us to really be talking about transforming our systems and stop acting like we can't.
And that's Tabitha Moore, former president of the Rutland NAACP.
Tabitha, thank you very much.
No problem.
We are getting reactions today, thoughts, ideas about what needs to be done next in Vermont, in our own communities, as we carry on a conversation about racism, about safety, about policing. We have more voices to come, including yours. We'd love to hear your perspective and where you think we go next. What do we do? What is the action now that the Chauvin verdict has come through?
And I just, before we get into this, I just wanted to clarify one thing, that when we talk about BIPOC, we are talking about Black, Indigenous, and people of color.
That's right. Yeah.
So
thanks.
We had an email wanting from somebody that was a little confused by that. So I just wanted to, as we continue this conversation, just wanted to add that in there.
Thanks, Connor. And the reason people use BIPOC is to not just necessarily have a blanket people of color statement, but also to include and illuminate and sort of amplify the voices of Black Americans and the voices of Indigenous Americans who have for so long often been silenced.
Absolutely.
Let's go to Madison, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Madison. Thanks for calling.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for taking my call today.
Yeah, I'd love to hear what you're thinking.
It is a mixture of emotions, to be frank. Yesterday, as I was working, I had a notification come through my phone from the New York Times that the verdict was pending. And, you know, tears started welling up. And I was shaking, and I'm still shaking today. And after the verdict was read, three guilty, 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 there were tears, I was still shaking, and there was that sense of relief. And oddly enough, as another listener said, I had to remind myself to breathe. And what I'm feeling right now...
Oh, we lost Madison. Madison, call back. I thought that might be... an important pause there, but it sounds like we missed your call. We lost you. So do call back. We want to get that in, and we want to hear what you're feeling and thinking now. In the meantime, let's go to Monica, who's also calling in from Burlington. Hi, Monica.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the parallels in society and looking at what we can do to help young people learn that they are being heard, that we can change our school systems, which is, you know, The schools may have systems in place to correct teachers who maybe do something that they shouldn't be doing. But if it doesn't show full circle what the outcome is and show that students are being heard when they make a complaint about a racist incident, it's leaving the students feeling that they've been unheard and that a problem has not been solved. So I think that changing our school system to show students who do stand up that they are being heard, and also to look at who's standing up. Because if there is a racist incident that occurs in the school and only one person reports it or two people report it, that is also the problem of the school. The school should be encouraging students to understand the importance of their voice, the importance of standing up, whether you are the victim of an incident or a bystander, as we've seen from this. It's the bystanders who have helped bring us to what happened yesterday. So looking at what's lacking in our schools, I think can encourage our young people in a safe setting to find their voice and have the courage to stand up and show them that they make a difference.
Monica, thanks. I appreciate that perspective. And I want to share that we were hoping to get a voice of a Vermont educator into this conversation today, because we anticipate this may be something that classes and teachers and students are talking about today, but also that it may be a challenge for some teachers and some educators to figure out how to discuss this. And we weren't able to get a voice into the conversation as a guest as quickly as we had hoped to before we came on air. And I know that so many teachers are teaching right now, so it may not be possible for you to call in. But if you are an educator and this is something that you're thinking about how to talk with students about, we would love to hear your perspective as well. So again, 1-800-639-2211. Sadie wrote in to say, I feel relieved. Sad that accountability for a murder seen on video was ever in doubt. We have a long way to go. Policing in this country needs a major overhaul to ensure justice and equity for all.
Now, Jessica, when we talk about all of this stuff, and I'm curious, what do you think those what would the conversations with you look like walking out of the courtroom if you were if you were there?
If I was there as a defense attorney
for yes.
Mr. Chauvin? Okay. What would that conversation look like? Frankly, the conversation would have needed to happen before the verdict came in. I'm sure that Derek Chauvin's attorneys prepared him for both possibilities. You would certainly need to explain to your client or the person you're representing what would happen if the verdict was guilty. And I believe that Derek Chauvin was taken into custody. I don't know if he was in custody throughout the trial or not, but he was certainly taken into custody after the verdict. So presumably those conversations were had beforehand, literally if the verdict is guilty, here's what's going to happen. The jurors are each going to get asked if this was their verdict. And then, perhaps his attorneys made some sort of argument if the statute allowed in Minnesota for him to remain, out of custody pending sentencing, but they would have explained that to him. So all of those conversations certainly would have needed to happen to prepare Derek Chauvin for whatever the outcome turned out to be.
Yeah, let's see here if we can get Madison back on the line, who's calling in from Burlington. Madison, thank you. I'm sorry that the call dropped. You were right in the middle of saying something that I really wanted to hear.
Thank you. I'm sorry that dropped as well. I was talking about the range of emotions I was going through yesterday. Tears, shaking, relief, and, the sad realization. As Austin Channing Brown said, that accountability is good, which is what we had yesterday with the verdict. But just treatment while we are alive would be better. And the thought that I had after hearing the verdict was wanting to hold tight to every Black, Brown, Indigenous, Asian, and person of color out there who has carried and borne the awful family secret of American racism and toxic harm. It is the family secret, our true ugly, of white supremacy and the intentional dehumanization and racial trauma that is now out there in the world. The world has seen with the video that was captured of the murder of George Floyd. America, the world now sees America's ugly secret. And here is where we are. Here is what I feel is this monumental shift that has happened for Black people and other people of color, is that we are not going to keep that family secret anymore. It is a burden that we've carried our entire lives. And the exhaustion that I know other Black folks I've been speaking with over the past year, the exhaustion that we've been experienced, I truly believe what that is that we have finally seen that the family secret is out, and we don't have to carry it anymore, and we don't have to cover for this veneer of good. This veneer of American exceptionalism that is. And what I'm calling for personally, for every white Vermonter, every white person out there, is to do the work. There's this white privilege that everyone, all the white folks are able to take advantage of without even thinking.
it is theirs.
Can you
and when we talk about next steps, when it comes to education and health care and policing on black and brown bodies, white people know exactly how they expect and want themselves and their children to be treated. All we are asking for is the same. Mm-hmm. And as I said to a group of friends recently, and I'll give space to other folks here, what I want in life personally and what I want for other people of color out there is to be as carefree as white people are. Because the truth is, even as we are out there living our lives of joy, it is always tinged with pain and terror of what could happen. Is my brother safe if he's driving? Are my nephews safe if they're simply walking down the road? Will they make it home tonight? It is a level of terror that people of color carry in this country, and we've been carrying for over 400 years, and it's time for it to end. We are done, and as the Vermont branches of the NAACP have said in their reaction letter to the verdict, we are done dying.
Madison, you talked about next steps. I'm curious, can you give us a tangible, you know, maybe a few, like just a list of what next steps you would like to see white Vermonters take towards equality or racial justice?
Yes, I do. You know, there are personal things folks can do, but really we need to codify things. We are a nation of laws. We have a social contract as a civilized society that we engage in together. I have reached out to the state legislature, and this morning I spoke with the Social Equity Caucus about having a day of remembrance and action on May 25th, the horrible anniversary of the killing of George Floyd, that I want to see on an annual basis. Just as we have a day of remembrance for the Holocaust, as we have our day of remembrance for 9/11, we as a society should have this day of remembrance of racial injustice that has been done from the founding of this nation. And the two concrete steps I'd like to see first, just as Germany has done in acknowledging and moving towards restorative justice on the Holocaust, they have education that tells their full ugly truth. We do not do this here in our country on genocide and slavery and segregation and the continuing harm that is being done to people of color that is written into our laws. We know right now down in the state of Georgia that there are laws in place to disenfranchise voters based on race. This is our ugly truth. I would like to see the state of Vermont put into place education for our children, for all of us, that owns the harm done and teaches it so that we can learn from it and atone. And then on the front of restorative justice, the next step would be to follow the leader in this case. President Biden has put in place for all policies, all cabinets, all of the work done at the federal level to make sure that a lens, racial equity lens is in place on all efforts. So, of course, what that means is when we think of housing, healthcare, education, policing, we should have that racial equity lens in place on all of those. Mayor Moreau Weinberger in his State of the City gave an alarming statistic from 2019 that of 6,000 households in the city of Burlington, only 18 were black homeowners.
18, wow.
18 out of 6,000.
Madison, thank you so much for your call, your perspective, and everything that you just offered. We're inviting you to share your reflections and reactions to yesterday's verdict in the trial of former Minneapolis officer Derek Chauvin and the murder of George Floyd.
We're hearing from many Vermonters today, and let's get the perspective now of Tim Bilodeau, Chief of Police for the University of Vermont Police Services. Chief Bilodeau, thank you for talking with us today.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
What was your reaction to hearing the verdict?
You know, I think for me, in our department, when we see accountability component and of criminal conduct by anybody, and particularly our people in our own profession, that's it, and that it works its way in the justice system in a way that is just, then that's a good thing. There's a community trust component around that, obviously. So that's something that adds, you know, a layer of care for our community that we think, you know, that accountability measure is shown in that way. So
you're at the intersection here of college campuses, which are often areas where activism takes place and in some cases pushes the country to more action. And UVM yeah. Police Services, you're a deputized police force. So you are also an actual police force. A lot of schools have campus security, which is slightly different than a deputized police force. So given your perspective, given the population that you work with, and given what many are calling for, a need for change, a dramatic need for change in how we think about policing in this country, what do you as chief of UVM Police Services do now to move this conversation forward and perhaps even to change the way your department operates and is perceived in your community?
Sure. You know, one of the first layers I would note is that we're an accredited police agency, so a sort of the standardization of policy and practice is built into what we've done for a couple of decades in Vermont. Having said that, you know, there's certainly an evolution for an evolution toward really considering the collaborative effort on our response to delivering public health and public safety. And as Madison said earlier, I kind of caught a little bit of what she was talking about with a comprehensive approach to education, to healthcare, and to policing. It's all in the same intersection, right? So, I mean, for us, we work collaboratively on and integratively with our partners every day. So for us, policing and public safety is a daily conversation we have with our mental health providers at UVM. It's a daily conversation with our residential life folks. It's a daily conversation with our healthcare folks on how we're going to respond. And when I say how we are going to respond, we really do look at it as a team approach. Like the police, we hold a component of it. We can no longer be everything. Just because we're on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we've built a system into public safety and how we respond to emergency doesn't mean that we can respond to everything. So that's a continual evolution for us at UVM Police, at UVM, and many of our other communities, but I'm only speaking for us right now, it's part of how we do business. It's part of our culture. Our officers expect that they are part of the conversation when they are involved with a mental health response about who's going to be the best fit for responding to that, for those in-the-moment calls, for instance.
Chief Bilodeau, can I ask you, Vermont in general and around the country, and I know for your department at times, although I don't know right now, there has been a real shortage of officers. Various departments have really struggled to fill their ranks. Now, some would say that's okay, we don't need as many police officers, and again, that we need to rethink how we address justice, how we address crises. However, it's also an issue of, are you getting the right people? Are your departments able to recruit the kind of police officers that you want for the 21st century? And if not, how will we ever get to the point where, if we're going to continue to have police services that do the same thing they have in the past in the sense of the organizational structure, that you have officers who are also committed to that same kind of work? How much of an issue is that?
Well, it is an issue, absolutely. And first of all, getting police officers at all is a bit of a battle for everybody. But having said that, I've been around in the business for more than three decades, I have to admit. That's a long time. But, the law enforcement component, that's a tool that we use in our public safety mission, but it's not everything. And even the way we use it is always considered in its impact, right? And how we hire people now, we certainly are looking for people with, social work and community building expertise, right? And that's not necessarily something we were looking for 30 years ago. I can safely say that, actually, because I've been around through the whole thing. And so for our processes, there's a big emphasis to say, hey, what is you delivered in the past and the and how have you worked in teams? How collaborative are you? How do you see integrating the community in the work you do? We're not perfect at that by any stretch, but that's the direction we're moving in our hiring processes and in our performance evaluations for our teams. And for how we do business with our community partners too, when we're looking for that feedback with people, we work really closely along a lot of these areas, and we push back on our partners and say, hey, we're the police, we're on all the time, but we can't respond to that, and let's start considering a way that is going to be the most effective way to help the community to respond to this public health thing, for instance, or
whether
it's a go ahead.
No, I was going to just say I appreciate that and appreciate that perspective. That's Tim Bilodeau, Chief of Police for the University of Vermont Police Services. And I know you got to run, so thank you very much, Chief Bilodeau. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
And this gets us back to what we were discussing at the very beginning of the program with Jessica Brown, supervising attorney in the Chittenden County Public Defender Office and soon to be Vermont Law School visiting professor of criminal law and procedure. And Jessica, I would love to bring you back in here because you were talking at the beginning about ways individuals can think about an appropriate response, when to call police officers into a situation and when not to. And Chief Bilodeau is saying in some ways the same thing, that there are times where people are calling the police department and it shouldn't be a police response. And so maybe that's an area of common consideration for how we think as a community about who to call when and if we have the resources to know who to call instead of police officers when it's an inappropriate situation for police to respond to. How do we get to that point?
I absolutely agree that there is some overlap in the sense that we ask our law enforcement agencies to do things that they are not trained to do, right? I mean, part of the answer, Jane, is money, right? Like, imagine if, instead of paying $300,000 to someone to leave the police force, that money was going into building a robust mental health, a more robust mental health agency that everyone in the community would know to call if someone's having a mental health crisis, rather than calling a police officer who is maybe has minimal training, but is not a psychologist or psychiatrist or a trained, mental health professional to be able to respond to someone having a mental health crisis. So, part of this does have to be a discussion about why we continue to pour money into law enforcement agencies under the premise that creating bigger and bigger law enforcement agencies will make us safer, when in fact we know that the opposite is true, right? The way to stop racist violence by the police, one way to stop it is to minimize police contact with people in the community. But the way we do that is by, number one, making sure that people in our communities have the services that they need, right? And number two, and the way that we get them those services is by financially investing in those services so that people in our communities know where to turn without turning to the police. And I hope that law enforcement agencies are on board with this concept, because they shouldn't want to be responding to mental health crises. They should want trained mental health professionals. They should want trained medical professionals to be responding to medical emergencies and mental health emergencies. They should want community members responding to other types of, smaller incidences that maybe don't involve violence. There's a conversation sort of starting and growing around the country about whether police should even be responding to traffic stops. Like, we know, in our state that Black people of color get disproportionately pulled over by the police. And that is often, we see nationally, the type of situation that ends up with someone being killed by the police. So we need to be minimizing those contacts. And the way we do that is by coming up with other responses in those situations.
Thank you, Jessica. Let's go to Russ in Williamstown. Russ, how you doing?
Hey, I am doing great. Thank you for getting me on. So just to give people a little bit of background, I have 35 years in law enforcement. I'm still currently a deputy sheriff. I also did a term as assistant judge, which if you don't know what that is, you can think of it as a mini jury of two people who sit on each side of a law-trained judge. I received training at Vermont Law School as a hearing officer and to do uncontested divorces. So here's what I would like to say, and that is that the core problem, I believe, is systemic racism and poverty. I've often said that if we raised educated, well-adjusted children, I would be out of a job. Part of the problem is that police officers do respond to everything, and you never know what you're going to be doing literally 2 seconds from now. There's a police saying that the job is 98% tedium and 2% terror. You talk about having professional screeners, I assume, that are interceding in mental health issues. But what do you do, as happened in one of the calls that I took for that, where I was had talked the person into going up to the hospital with me to be screened, and she asked for a drink of water. I let her have it, and then she took a bite right out of the glass.
Hmm.
That's something that screeners aren't trained to handle with.
So, Russ, if that's the case, so that there may need to be more social services, more wraparound services, but that you say a screener isn't going to be prepared to deal with that, so you still see a role for law enforcement in crisis situations?
I do. I clearly believe that we do need more and better training for police officers. And I applaud the belief that de-escalation should be one of the goals of police work.
So, Russ, I'm going to cut you off only because we're short on time. I appreciate that perspective, and thank you for sharing it. And I want to go now to Mary Gannon for a final thought here. Mary is a senior consultant for the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Diversity and the founder of Community Equity Collaboration. And I just need to note that VPR has hired the Vermont Partnership to audit, create, and implement an improvement plan for VPR's own recruitment and hiring practices. Mary, we just have a minute, but I want to get to your point here as well.
Thank you, Jane, and thanks for all that shout out. Yes, I just wanted to really affirm what Madison, who called in earlier, spoke to around just really giving attention to these deep structural hundreds of years worth inequities. And really, you know, Madison's call is to white folks, is that we as white people need to be willing to get uncomfortable. We might have to stay uncomfortable, but this work of shifting and disrupting white supremacy culture is really on us. And so I just want to, I know we say these things a lot, and I know that in this current moment, you know, it feels even a more of a greater sense of urgency, but I want to say to my white counterparts, there are so many ways to get involved. There are NAACP chapters. There's so many ways to get in the conversation and to get support as you're in the conversation when it starts to feel uncomfortable. And I know we can move the needle forward, but we have got to engage with this work.
Mary, thanks for that perspective. Mary ending us there saying, you know, this is a conversation and a movement for white people at this point as well. Appreciate that perspective and really appreciate the perspective of Jessica Brown, supervising attorney in the Chittenden County Public Defender Office and soon to be Vermont Law School visiting professor of criminal law and procedure. Jessica, thank you for being with us this full hour to share your thoughts.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
And thanks to everyone who has weighed in with your perspective and your ideas about where we take this conversation and where we take this action next here in the Northeast. Thank you all for listening to this special program from VPR News.